In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
Let's talk about the human brain, how to teach it, how to train it, and how to celebrate all its differences. From SDPB, today is Monday, August 12th. This is In the Moment. This hour, a new FDA-approved device is helping some South Dakotans train their brains to not hear the ringing of tinnitus. Then you're not the only one who sometimes thinks you're losing your mind. We'll get to know a business model in Aberdeen that reaches residents with the science of neuroplasticity. We'll also talk about a stage play featuring a character whose unique brain turns to solving the death of a neighbor's dog. We'll explore the human impact of alcohol addiction. And on a lighter note, we will talk about the financial warnings that sound like warning bells for a zombie apocalypse that isn't coming. We'll protect our brains from the election cycle. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakotans who are plagued by ringing, buzzing, or whooshing in their ears may have a new treatment option available. The University of South Dakota now offers the Lanier Tinnitus Treatment Device. Lindsay Jorgensen is chair of and professor in USD's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, and she's with us now from our SCPB studios on the campus of the University of South Dakota. Dr. Jorgensen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a new tool in the toolbox. Tell us a little bit about what is happening in the brain when people hear those ringing sounds or the staticky sounds that won't go away.
Absolutely. You know, tinnitus or tinnitus, whichever you want to say, is a sound that's in your brain, but there is no stimulus. There's nothing going on in the environment that would cause that sound to be heard. So there's a variety of options that we've had for quite a while in trying to help people learn to not pay attention to it. So I want to be very clear, and when people say, oh, there's nothing you can do about it, that's not true. We can actually help a brain kind of reorganize those sounds. And there may be a variety of options, but one of these new and exciting devices is this Lanier product. And the Lanier product is the only FDA-approved device to assist with the treatment of tinnitus.
What is happening when people just ignore it and say there's nothing that you can do? Is that coming from other people who are frustrated and say there's no sound, so get over it? Why is it ignored so much when it can be so disruptive to your life?
You know, when we think about, when we ask a group of people, oh, do you have tinnitus? You know, there's a large group of people that have it. And for about 80% of people, they really can just kind of ignore it. And, yep, it's there. It's not affecting my life. But for 20% of people, it really does affect their life. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that statement of you can just ignore it often comes from other medical professionals or friends or family that just say, get over it. Well, that's really hard for some people. And so, we want to be able to provide some treatment options and things to help these people learn to, quote, ignore it. But they need assistance in getting to that point.
All right. So let's talk about an assessment first before we talk about this treatment device and how it works and what's new about it. When someone comes and tells you they have this problem, where do you begin with assessment?
So first, we're going to start with a hearing test just to make sure that there's nothing wrong in the periphery. A good chunk of people who have tinnitus actually do have hearing loss. And so one of the options for that is to provide them the sounds that they don't hear normally. So maybe talking about hearing aids or other assistive technologies that could help them hear. So we always kind of start with that. But especially if people are saying, nope, hearing is not really my concern. My real concern is tinnitus. We talk about it. We talk about how often does it happen? Where does it happen? What can you do to make it better? What makes it worse? We do some questionnaires. One of my things when I'm doing that is I'm kind of doing a medical evaluation to say, what kind of things do I need to do before we move to maybe some of the treatment options? Do they need to go see a physician? Do we need to do some other kind of mental health counseling and bring in other specialists? Or do we just talk about maybe some of those treatment options that we have?
All right. So how does this device work?
You know, this is an interesting device because historically we've gone through some of the self-driven devices. or product programs where I give people some homework. They go home, they try different things, they come back, we talk about how those are working, we give some more things for them to do on their own. That works really well. It's kind of a traditional tinnitus rehabilitation treatment. This device also provides us some kind of more passive type treatments. This device is a device that you wear over your ears, and it's like headphones, and there are some sounds that they listen to. At the same time, there's a tongue tip stimulator. Using bimodal stimulation is really how this device works. And we've known for a really long time that bimodal stimulation really helps retrain the brain in things like pain. But this is one of the first times that this has been used to really help train in some of those other types of devices like the treatment of tinnitus. So the goal is with this bimodal stimulation is hearing as well as feeling that kind of tingle on your tongue to retrain the brain to not perceive that tinnitus as annoying, as dangerous. For some reason, that brain has classified the tinnitus as annoying or dangerous and something that we should pay attention to.
Yeah. What does it feel like, that tingle on your tongue? Because I imagine some people are hesitant to put something in their mouth and say, oh, you're going to feel something. Like, well, what? Tell me exactly.
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of scary because, yeah. You know, when we say there are electrodes, that is a scary word. But it really is just like kind of a almost like a vibration or just a little tingle. It's really not painful. It's a very, very light stimulus. You know, there have been other treatments that we've looked at for the treatment of tinnitus. A skin stimulator where you wear like a wristband, you know, and other things. The nice thing with the tongue stimulator is that it's a pretty good direct contact to one of the 10 cranial nerves. Additionally, is that we don't need to prep the skin or anything like that because there's saliva that helps us. And so we also don't need to turn up that kind of tingling as high or that electricity as high because it has such good connection to the tongue. But really, it's not harmful. And once again, this has been FDA approved, so we know that there's no way that it could hurt you.
And you're going to use this a little bit of time per day or for how long? And I know it's not one size fits all, but in general, this is a daily treatment?
So, you know, this the treatments really started, this theory started back in 2010 in Ireland. And so then it went out into the general market in 2019 in Ireland, and then it got FDA approval here in the United States in 2023. So it's been out about a year here in the United States, but we've had it in Ireland for about 5 years. And what we found is that a 12-week course of 2 30-minute sessions really is the way to help the brain retrain.
All right. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment. Our guest is Lindsay Jorgensen, chair of and professor in the University of South Dakota's Department of Communication, Sciences, and Disorders. And we're talking about this Lanier device. It's a new FDA-approved device, which is one more treatment of tinnitus. If you get that that ringing or that buzzing or that whooshing or static sound in your ears, you probably know what we're talking about. Lindsay, final thoughts about there's so much on the market now that people think that they can treat some things on their own. How important is doing addressing problems like this with a professional?
You know, I really suggest seeing a professional, seeing an audiologist, getting your hearing assessed, talking about the different options. And that's really, really important because doing it just yourself is not going to be a long-term effective treatment.
Yeah,
we have many options for people.
We will leave it there for now. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
A mental health service provider won the grand prize in July's Aberdeen Business Pitch Competition. Minds Matter offers neurocognitive therapy to adults with brain injuries or cognitive changes, and they took home the $10,000 prize at the competition. This is a prize to help launch businesses with innovation to the next level. Tiffany Haft is a speech-language pathologist and owner of Minds Matter in Aberdeen and is joining us via Zoom. Tiffany, welcome. Thank you so much and congratulations.
Thanks for having me.
So we were just talking about a device that addresses how the brain processes sounds or the lack of those sounds in tinnitus, and you're well-versed in neuroplasticity. So before we talk about your business and the competition that you won. Help us understand how the brain changes, grows, makes connections throughout a lifetime.
So it's interesting, you know, I'm 46 and I think of back in my early years hearing about you don't want to hit your brain because you can't grow new brain cells. We now know that we can in certain parts of our brain. We can grow new brain cells, but more importantly, throughout our brain, we can grow new connections. And that's what we really base our therapy on, that we can change our brain through the way we use it. We can change how blood flow works in the brain. So as we see those changes in life, we can speed up processing all of those types of things.
All right. A little bit about this competition, because this is a Northern Innovation and Startup Center, the Aberdeen Development Corporation, and you have to basically pitch your idea to people. Tell me a little bit about the process of explaining what you do and asking for the support to take Minds Matter, your business, to its next iteration.
Well, first off, this competition, Aberdeen putting this together, you know, with the cooperation of the Northern Innovation Center and the Development Corporation, for a business of my size, $10,000 is going to really help us out a lot. It was an interesting process of first describing what we do and how we help the community, and then a very interesting night of being in front of five judges and getting to put together our best ideas, and excellent competition. So we're glad that we were able to win, but it was really fun to have all of these new businesses in Aberdeen showcased.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what you do, particularly beginning with the idea that if you think something is off, early intervention is important. Help us understand what you mean by that.
Minds Matter stems from myself. In 2012, I had West Nile, and I got to experience brain fog where I could do a Sudoku puzzle every night. At that point, I couldn't. Things were falling off the schedule. I just had this overall brain fog. And at that time, knowing when I went into providers, they were wonderful providers, but just, you know, them saying this will improve with time. And me as a speech pathologist, knowing that I need to get after making some changes. And it really led to this 10-year journey of me researching different ways to improve the brain, looking into neuroplasticity, going all over the United States to different clinics to see how are we able to treat this better in Aberdeen. Just because you live in a rural area doesn't mean you shouldn't get that type of treatment.
Yeah. So many times we make excuses. You're getting older, you're stressed, you're too busy, you're in menopause or perimenopause, you're still coming off of COVID. What are some of the other things that we do to sort of dismiss this? And what are we dismissing? Are we dismissing the hard work that comes from, or the life changes? Or what do you notice from patients who say, I kept thinking it's no big deal, it's going to pass, and then it didn't?
I think everybody assumes there's nothing that can be done. So why go in and get a diagnosis? And here we always say, this is the place where you can come and say, I think I'm losing my mind, and I'm not going to tell you you're fine. I'm going to say, well, let's do some tests. Let's get some numbers. It's called a quantitative EEG, but it's really a way as I get to look at your brain from an entirely different way and see how it functions. And I get to say, yes, you're experiencing what seems like memory loss, but it's really attention, or it is the fact that you can't hear, or it's, you know, different factors. And we look at what can you do so in 1 year you're better off than you are today.
What can you do? Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the therapy plans that you are laying out for people. All, again, not one size fits all, very individualized, but broadly speaking, what are some of the expectations that you might be asked of you?
I always tell everybody that comes here that therapy works if you work. So you don't come in here and I wave a magic wand once a week, but it's really, here's the little tiny changes you're going to make every day to every little habit when it comes to memory and attention to improve your cognitive function. And then there's also the really easy to avoid things. You know, hearing loss is a huge factor. And then people knowing what is your blood sugar, your blood pressure, do you exercise? You know, what changes can you make? And really showing them how it impacts their brain really helps them to understand why they need to make these changes.
When you were coming back from the brain fog of West Nile, was there a time frame that you put toward it? Are these temporary things, or are they lifestyle changes that really should be done forever? I'm thinking, you know, if you tweak your ankle or you hurt your knee, you might have physical therapy and rehab, and you might be running a marathon the next day. Other things, you know, if you hurt, you might never really be going back to doing some things that you used to do. You might have a permanent shift. For the brain fog of something like an illness coming off of COVID, coming off of West Nile or Lyme disease, is there a time frame?
Well, there's that initial period of intensity where you might be coming in once or twice a week, or I work with people all over the state, so it might be coming in for the initial visit, and then there's telemed after that. But there's that period of intense therapy where, yes, you might be dedicating some time to this. But then as it goes on, I always equate it to exercise. This is something you're going to do for the rest of your life because it's good to have these brain habits. It's good to use your attention and memory. And I really look at functional ways that people can tuck in throughout their day, so it's not sitting down for an hour of therapy. Mm-hmm. But when we go through therapy and I point out how people are using their memory in their day-to-day lives or relying on their technology, it's really helpful for people to say, oh, in this little moment every day, I could use my memory, and that becomes an exercise.
Mm. Okay, so that's what I do when I forget somebody's name or I forget a word. I immediately pause and say, don't look it up. think, give yourself. Then it might take 60 seconds is all, but we're so used to having, you know, to be able to reach for, what is that actor's name who stars in that one movie? And you can find it on your phone. Is that a good thing to just sit and give yourself your brain time to process?
It's an excellent thing. And because of the technology that we all have in our pocket now,
Yeah. We
are really changing how we use our brain. I look at the coffee crowd that would get together at the cafe I worked at in Bristol, South Dakota growing up. And those guys would argue over which date the crop went in 1975. And it was a discussion. Yeah. Versus when I get together with my friends now, I'll say, I think it was this actor. Somebody pulls their phone out of the pocket. Nope, it was this actor. None of us had to engage all of those brain cells that we had to before we had the technology.
Yeah. Someone says, what did you do this summer? And I sometimes say, I don't know. I will have to look at the photos on my phone. And then I say, okay, hold on. Let me just think about what I did this summer instead of going. But to your point, we're shifting those things. Some of those are good shifts and some of them are not so much. I guess what I'm trying to get at here is, like, when you think about our executive function and the huge volume for people who have healthy brains and are not having memory problems, but every once in a while they forget something or something falls off your plate or falls out of your mind, it always comes back to me for, you have so many things to remember. There's no way you could remember everybody's name because you met 300 people at this party. And that's okay. But sometimes you have to make a change and slow things down. And sometimes you just have to accept the fact that you're going to forget an appointment every once in a while. When is it a problem for you? When is it a problem for other people in your life? And when is it something that you should shrug your shoulders and go, yeah, I've just got too much going on right now to remember all the things all the time?
And I think for every person, it's a little bit different. But I think we all know ourselves so well. For memory loss to show up in the physician's office on a clinical screener, to be gathered at that moment and diagnosed, you have to be so impaired. I would prefer somebody coming in at age, 30, 40, 50, 60, saying Alzheimer's runs in my family, I'm worried about this and it's a day-to-day concern. And we do a 1-2 session. Let's look at your habits. Let's really talk about what went on with your loved one. Let's look at what factors could impact you. Because I think knowledge is power. So if you're worrying about something, getting that appointment and really talking it over and getting that anxiety out of your brain is a really important thing.
Yeah.
So the earlier, the better. I would rather have 1 to 2 visits and fix something than actually have a diagnosis of dementia. And we're looking at a lifelong therapy at that point.
Right. All right. The business is called Binds Matter. We've been talking with Tiffany Haft. She is a speech language pathologist, a certified brain injury specialist. And thank you so much for being here with us. I feel like we could talk with you about all kinds of things in the future, too. So come back and see us again.
Well, thank you for your time.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. If you're not retired yet, let me ask you this. Do you think that you will receive benefits from Social Security when you do retire? And if you say no, you're not alone, because a 2023 Gallup poll showed 47% of non-retirees in the U.S. believe they will get nothing from Social Security when they leave the workforce. But that might be a politically motivated urban legend. Financial therapist Rick Kaler is here to explain what you can expect from Social Security and how to smartly plan for your retirement. Kaler is a wealth advisor. He's president of Kaler Financial in Rapid City, and he's one of the leaders internationally of financial therapy movement. He's seated in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Rick, welcome back.
It's good to be back, Lori. Good to be back in studio.
I love this column because it says things have intensified during the political silly season. Can we all call it the silly season up to the election?
Well, I was just thinking about that because we've called it the silly season in the past.
Have we? I have not heard that before.
Given the rhetoric and the political polarization,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what word
describes
the season.
Right. Mm-hmm. The silly season makes you feel a little bit better about it, and maybe the reality is it's pretty intense. But you hear this all the time. Social Security is going broke. It's not going to be there. I remember hearing when I was 32, maybe, a radio story that said, if you are above the age of 30, you'll never retire. And I remember internalizing that, going, well, I can never retire. I was 32 at the time. And not really processing, like, why am I hearing, at that age, not processing, why am I hearing this, just internalizing the fear of it. What are you hearing?
Yeah, it's the same thing. And like you said, it's an urban legend. It just doesn't die that at this particular date, Social Security will be broke. And, of course, what are you going to do? Exactly what you did, saying, well, okay, so I've got to plan my life around Social Security not being there.
Yeah.
And this is the crazy-making thing about this, Lori, is that when somebody says Social Security will be broke, they're mostly right if you finish the sentence. And typically, what is correct is that the Social Security fund will be broke by 2035. Now, that takes a whole lot of explanation as to, well, how can you say that the Social Security fund is going to be broke, but there's still going to be money to fund Social Security? And it's just not a good soundbite when you have to talk for a paragraph to explain things. And it can further your own political goals in the moment of what you're attempting to do, which is, if it's to build fear and to demonize the other side, saying that Social Security will be broke by 2035 can serve that purpose.
Right. And both political parties do this. So it's an equal opportunity.
Absolutely, both.
Yeah. Well, how does Social Security work?
Yeah.
Tell us how this works.
And it's not difficult. In the past, the Social Security tax, which is our payroll tax, and we all pay it, went into a fund, and out of that, the benefits were paid. So for many, many years, we were overtaxed according to the amount of proceeds needed to fund Social Security. So the amount grew in this fund. Then that money was loaned to the U.S. government in the form of T-bills. So you can also hear folks say, well, Social Security Fund was robbed. Mm. Well, it wasn't robbed. It loaned the money to the U.S. government. At a point in time, I forget exactly what year this happened. Maybe it was a decade ago. I forget. The amount going out of that fund exceeded what was coming in. So very gradually, the excess amount in that fund has been paying the overage because we have not been taxing enough. So in the past, we taxed too much. For a very short period of time, it was just perfectly matched. And now we're not taxing enough to sustain Social Security. So we're using the money from the savings account. So the savings account is going to be broke by 2035, meaning we only have the tax to rely on. The tax funds 83% of all Social Security benefits. So at the worst, what happens in 2035 is Social Security benefits drop by 17%. They don't disappear.
Still significant, still worth talking about, but not the zombie apocalypse that some might have you believe. Now, to be clear, Social Security benefits are not just for retirees. Other people are getting these benefits as that safety net, right? This is why it's not just that so many people have retired and not as many people are working. It's that, you know, other people are getting the benefits too. But let's talk about those retirees, because to the point that we started out with, there are some pretty young people who decided they'd never be able to retire. And wouldn't it be wonderful if I had internalized that message to say, oh, I better save so much more of my paycheck. Instead, I felt hopeless to prepare for my own retirement for a significant period of time until I matured out of that. So for a lot of people to think that they can't retire, they shrug their shoulders and then they do nothing. And that's probably not a good plan.
Right. You can shrug your shoulders that it's hopeless, and why worry or why do anything? And then you can potentially overcompensate that, well, I've really got to save because Social Security won't be there. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, like with a lot of things, somewhere in between. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, Social Security doesn't provide a cushy retirement. It's minimal at best. So it makes total sense for all of us to save for retirement so that we can have something to supplement the Social Security. But the Social Security is going to be there, and that's a strong statement. And I completely believe that. When Social Security started, I think the average mortality age of a male was 66, and they set Social Security at 65. Not much chance you're going to collect on Social Security. Yeah. If we were doing the same thing today, we'd set it Social Security age at 80.
Right.
So it's become the retirement plan of the U.S.
So how should we think differently about our own retirement, knowing, you know, we should get accurate information. We should ignore the alarmist rhetoric. I'm not telling you how to think politically, but, you know, think about the facts that you have, you know, when you cast your vote, fine. But when we're planning our own retirement based on the America that we live in today, how does this change how we plan for our retirement, knowing that Social Security will be there, but the funds in it could drop, and so you might not have a big, you know, as big of a payout as you maybe thought you would, and also that payout is not, retirement, it can't be your only thing.
And I would add, Lori, probably one of the easiest things to fix all the problems in the U.S. is funding Social Security.
Really?
You could take 100 CFPs, put them in a room, and within 3 hours, they'd have it fixed. There are so many variables. Increasing the retirement age, increasing the payroll tax. There's so many levers that can be pulled to fix this. Mm-hmm. It is a really simple problem to solve. So I really don't even think you're going to see that 17% drop. I don't think you'll see any drop because Social Security is a third rail. People over 65 tend to vote proportionately higher than any other age group. It will be fixed in one way or another. But with that said, it's really important that we provide for our retirement. And the earlier we start, the more effective that's going to be, the easier that's going to be, the lower percentage of our income will need to be set aside the earlier that we start. Mm.
Let's talk about that next time, because I'm curious about, there were some things on NPR before we started about new college graduates, you know, the kids who went through the pandemic, and those kids were getting their first jobs, trying to figure out what to do. And if you're not making a lot, how do you save for retirement beginning in your career? Can we talk about that in the future?
We can. We're already to the future, though. It just feels like we just got started.
We're already to the future. We're just getting started. Rick Kaler, wealth advisor, president of Kaler Financial in Rapid City. Several books on financial therapy for your consideration. We'll see you next time.
Take care. Thank you, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The Black Hills Playhouse closes out its 78th season with the production The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Emma Taylor plays lead character Chris Boone, and Lisa Wipperlin plays Judy, Chris's mother. Emma and Lisa are with us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Rapid City Spaces. Emma, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Lisa Wipperling, thank you for being here as well.
Yes, thank you for having me as well.
All right, you two. I remember when this book came out, and I remember reading the book, and it never would have occurred to me that it could have been a stage play because of the complexities of the text itself. But it went on to become a Tony-winning, award-winning play. And Emma, tell me a little bit about when you heard they were auditioning for this production. Had you read the book? Did you know the story? How did you enter the tale of Chris Boone?
So, yeah, funnily enough, I'd read the book a few years back. I decided to reread it for the audition. And I was hoping for the role, but I wasn't expecting it because as an actor, you can't quite just be like, oh, I'm totally going to get this role. You can't do that. Yeah. But I was really like, oh, I really understand Chris and I would love to play Chris. And funnily enough, that's where I ended up.
So how close is the script to the text of the book? Do they stick pretty closely to it or is it I have not seen the play. So is it a total reimagining or is it fairly close? Would I recognize it?
In terms of the plot, everything is exactly the same. The main difference is the book is all Chris's words and it's all in Chris's mind, whereas in a play, you can't just have that narration constantly going like you can in a book. So the way the play goes into Chris's mind is through its theatrical elements instead of just Chris's words.
All right. Lisa, tell me a little bit about the staging of the production then, with that in mind.
Yeah, well, I'll just tag on to that and say, because the stage play isn't all from Chris's voice, my character gets to read letters to Chris, and other characters are reading parts of her book, so it's quite interesting. The staging of the play, it's what a fun... If you come and see it, it is absolutely spectacle. If you want to see a theatrical production that has spectacle, ours does. Brittany did some beautiful projections, and all of the elements that are set comprise is a bunch of hexagons. So the whole stage is hexagons. And of those hexagons, different ones open up to become microwaves or doors, and other ones light up when we turn a light on in a room. And we have boxes and hexes that move around on stage and are built to represent beds and couches and ticket booths and train platforms and lots of things. So it's a very hyper theatrical production.
I love that, because one of the things I remember about the book, Emma, was that the way it immersed you inside the lead character's brain in a way that was beautiful and, you know, world opening, but then also sometimes agitating and tension filled. There were times when, you know, this is a character who, we should tell people who aren't familiar with any of it, you know, discovers the death of a neighbor's dog and then sets out to investigate it. Partially so he doesn't become accused of hurting the neighbor's dog. And he sees the world, he's mathematically like really, really bright, but not necessarily figuring out the emotions of other people. Now we would call this neurodivergent, maybe in some circles. Back then in the book, I don't even know if the author was thinking that when he wrote that, I'm not really sure. But being inside this character's mind. So tell me more, Emma, about being in the character, but then also having all these theatrical ways to represent the overwhelm of that and the creativity of that.
Of course. So we have an amazing ensemble who's adding a lot of elements. Like every now and then if Chris gets agitated, they'll add like a heartbeat in the background. There will be lighting changes. There will be sound changes to indicate that form of distress going on in her mind. And what I really wanted to bring to Chris was understanding. I didn't want to judge her for certain traits. I didn't want to like be mean to her in the way that so many characters in the show are mean to her. And I think that was my main thing, was I understand, like, how do I understand Chris and how do I learn to understand Chris?
Yeah.
And how do I learn to live in her world while still being authentic?
Yeah.
And that was a really great process for me to learn.
Is this your first role of this size?
Yes, this is the biggest role I've ever played. This is also my first professional season ever.
Wow.
I am in college, so I've been I've been doing educational shows over at the University of South Dakota, and the Black Hills Playhouse puts auditions up over at the university, so I auditioned over there. And
here we are.
Lisa, honestly, I'm really grateful to be here.
Lisa, working with Emma, the relationship between these two characters is difficult, and you're also creating a safe space between two actors to explore these things. What has working with Emma Taylor been like for you, Lisa?
Dream come true. No, I really love Emma. She really brought some great authenticity to the role as soon as I met her. I've played a lot of moms in my day, but I have never played a mom to a child with neurodivergence before. And there was a lot of communicating that needed to happen so that I could be as authentic in my character as possible as well. So, but we talked a lot about the character traits that are not your traits, Emma, that bring Chris to life in a different way, and what character traits maybe I don't have in my human life but needed to put on in order to create the role of Judy, to make this relationship as honest and alive as possible.
Yeah. All right. It runs until August 17th. Have you had an audience yet at all?
Yes, we have.
Okay. Tell me how some of those early reactions have been.
We had a park preview Saturday night, and then our official opening was yesterday matinee, and the audiences have been very receptive. Mm-hmm. There was a group of people that represented an autism group in the area. I don't know their title, but were very receptive and heartwarmed by the story that we told. So I'm very encouraged that people are going to come away with better understanding of stories like this.
And such an interesting example of a book where the author, you know, really said, I didn't do any research into, like, mm-hmm. Asperger's or the autism spectrum. I just wrote a book. I researched the, you know, the transportation system in London. And now mm-hmm. it has this life of its own with all these people who say, well, let's do this with it. Let's do that mm-hmm. with it. I yeah. love that part of this story. So, all right, you can see Emma and Lisa in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime at the Black Hills Playhouse until August 17th. Emma Taylor, thank you so much. Break a leg.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Lisa Wipperling, Dudo.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Chronic liver disease, most often connected to excessive alcohol use, is now the leading cause of death of people in their 30s in this state. Taylor Nielsen of Lead is one of those South Dakotans. He was 35. Now, Megan Luther is a freelance journalist, and she chronicled Nielsen's liver failure and death in a piece for South Dakota Newswatch. And she is joining us now from the campus of Dakota Wesleyan University in the Dan and Diane Desloria's family studio. Megan Luther, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This is an incredibly personal story that you have written about in South Dakota Newswatch, where a family really shares the details, even the indignities of this young man's disease in order to help others. Tell us a little bit about your connection to the family and coming to this story and an ability to tell it.
Sure. I ran into David Nielsen, Taylor's dad, in the Black Hills. And he was talking about his son and his son's struggles. And I proposed to him, you know, would he be willing to share his story? I think it's a powerful tool. You know, I could write all that I want to write about the topic, but in the end, as humans, I think we relate more to the human story. And when I started looking into the statistics for South Dakotans, I was shocked to find that it's the leading cause of death for South Dakotans in their 30s.
How did the pandemic impact that? I know liquor sales were up. Are they still up? Is it a blip? What did you learn in your research?
So liquor sales are up, which is, I don't think, a surprise to anyone. But what is surprising is that they haven't gone back down to pre-pandemic levels. So right now, last year, 2023, liquor sales were still up at more than 20% from a decade ago. And this is just liquor sales in liquor stores. This doesn't count grocery stores. This doesn't count restaurants. This doesn't count bars. And it's still a massive figure for the state of South Dakota.
So how does Taylor find out that this is a problem for him? Is it the addiction becomes a problem? The drinking becomes a problem? Or does he start having health problems and is still in denial about the drinking? Help us understand his medical journey.
So his medical journey ended up, he was drunk, hit his head, had a massive brain bleed, ended up in the ER, and that's when he got his official diagnosis. By that time, his skin was already yellow, his eyes, you know, the whites of his eyes were already yellow, so he was pretty far along, and unfortunately didn't come to a surprise to any of his family members or loved ones. Mm.
He is a candidate for a liver transplant, or should we say he might have benefited from one, but he does not get approved for one. What did you learn about people waiting for liver transplants?
It's a really complex system, and obviously there's several factors to consider, including medical urgency. They do a psychological exam when it comes to, you know, the health of the person, whether they're consuming a lot of bad foods or they're consuming a lot of alcohol. Those things all play in a role. And what's interesting is there's, you know, for those of us in South Dakota, there's only two close options to get a liver transplant. And it includes a lot of travel, especially if you live on the western part of the state. And so it's a complex issue. And what's the most interesting thing to me is each hospital, each liver transplant center gets to decide what criteria they consider. There's no federal guidelines or federal policy, and they vary from center to center. Mm.
Tell me about the moment when they find out, when the family finds out that he's not going to get a new organ.
You know, his father, Dave, is a very positive individual. And just like any parent, he was super uplifting to his child because he did not want Taylor to give up. And so he did not tell his son right away. In fact, he waited several weeks to tell his son that he was denied because he was afraid if he told him then, as severe as his condition was, that he would just ultimately give up and not try to become healthier in order to be a recipient for a liver.
This is a family disease. Addiction is a family disease, you write in your piece. How far do those ripples go out in Taylor's life? How many people end up being impacted by his decline and eventual death?
So he had the disease both on his mother's side and on his father's side. David had a brother who also suffered from alcoholism. And what's interesting is as I followed them through this journey, one of Taylor's cousins, David's nephew, who had been estranged from the family, but came to see Taylor when he heard about Taylor's condition. He showed up to the hospital Monument in Rapid City, and David realized that his nephew, who's in his early 40s, has yellowing skin and yellowing eyes. And so he encouraged his nephew to see a doctor, and now all of a sudden you have David taking care of his nephew and his son, trying to get them the help they need. Both are in denial, and in the end, unfortunately, the nephew, Trevor, actually passed away a week after Taylor.
That's heartbreaking. How powerful is that denial?
So strong. You know, I kind of talk about denial as a strong demon. And I think especially at a younger age, it's hard to accept that this is the end. And I, you know, I was in constant contact with David and Taylor, and I talked to Taylor hours before he was found unconscious. And he was in denial. He actually said to me, and I put it in the story, like, I'm healthy. I don't need hospice. And he was in denial to the very end.
Is there anything that you want people to take away from this piece that you think could save a life?
I think one of the things that was important as a journalist and then also giving justice to Taylor's story is Taylor, as you said in the beginning, laid it all out there. We saw the good, bad, and ugly, and he was willing to share it all, even the very embarrassing things. And one of the things I disclosed in the story at the end, because I thought it was important, is that I'm also in recovery, and I've been in recovery for 4 years. And the reason I disclosed it is one for two reasons. One, I don't think Taylor would have talked to me if I didn't quite understand where he's coming from. And two, secrets kill. And I think the more open we are, which is one of the reasons I wanted to do this story, the more we realize that other people deal with this crazy disease that doesn't make any sense. And I think the more open we are, the more chance we have to people to find treatment and to get better.
Megan Luther, thank you so much for bringing this story to the readers of South Dakota Newswatch. You can find it at sdnewswatch.org. And we'll put a link up on our website as well, so you can find it easily if you come through SDPB. But also just thank you for the story and joining us today. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.